Okay, the topic that we've been discussing is when I admit my faults and try to overcome them. Each person has faults. Each person has shortcomings. Some people are not concerned about them. Other people are really concerned about them. They fault themselves for every small thing that they do. And then you have some people who fall somewhere in the middle. We've discussed this from a couple of different standpoints. At the bottom of page 33, point number 4, talks about the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. I did want to have in a little bit Luke chapter 15, verse 21 read. Is there somebody that wants to turn over there and read that in a few minutes? Luke 15, verse 21. Okay, that'll be Lois. Before we get to that point, he says, the prodigal son of Luke 15 did not confess his sins while he was out having a big time. Think about that in terms of our culture today. When people are out doing the kinds of things that the prodigal son is associated with or was accused of by his brother, they're not thinking necessarily about confessing their wrongs or their misdeeds at that point. What are they thinking about? What's going through the mind? Rather than confess, they're
hiding it.
Well, they could be hiding it. There are some people who do that. They don't want anybody to know. So you do have that reaction. I saw two hands, Sherman, being...
They're enjoying it.
All right. You know, that could be secretly, that could be publicly, but they like that lifestyle, at least at the time. Okay. There's one other reaction that we might find. Enjoying it, maybe trying to be secretive about it, or what? Well, okay, you certainly have that too. There's still one other big point here.
They're not concerned about it.
Okay, and maybe they're so unconcerned about it, they boast about it. Do we not all know somebody that is involved with the kinds of things associated with this son in Luke chapter 15, and they brag about it? Guess what I did last Friday? Guess where I was over the weekend? Guess how much I drank? Guess how much I smoked as far as, you know, marijuana, those kinds of things. I outran the cops. The list just goes on and on and on with some folks. And people generally will not confess until what happens? All right, and there, if they're caught, their confession is not so much... It's not really real. It's not really sincere. It's not really repentance. It's the confession of, you got me. I'm on radar, I'm on the camera, whatever it is, and I'm going to acknowledge my guilt. And we said in the last class that some will not even do that. I mean, you can catch them red-handed. Well, that's not me, that's my brother, or that's my twin, or whatever it happens to be. But it's really interesting how people behave.
There are some who, you wouldn't call it confessing their sin necessarily, but will admit to it. In other words, will actually say, I did thus and so, and hey, look at me, or I'm, you know, that's fine. I guess maybe it's rebellion. I don't know what you would call it.
When it comes to sin, people are inclined to do almost anything but confess it. That seems to be the least likely option for many. And you have a lot of reasons for it. But some just want to rebel. Others will, like I say, do it and brag about it. They'll do it secretly. Some say we enjoy it, so we're going to do it. So it really is amazing as far as the wide range of reactions that we get. But still, that those things are not going to lead to heaven. There's only one way, and that's going to be repentance.
Romans, the first chapter, talks a lot about that. Not only do they do it, but others are encouraging them to do it.
Yeah. And people will sometimes try to just lead the way. And as they're involved with it, hey, come on, everybody's doing this. This is popular. You don't want to be left out. You know, you're the square, those kinds of things. So you do have that element or that aspect too. All right, picking up with that last point on this page, he says, it's only after the son reached a point where he had no money, no food, no friends, that he comes to his senses. He came to himself. He begins to long for home. And when at last he came to his father, he said, and we'll pick up the verse here in just a couple of minutes. A couple things here I think that stand out. Item number one, when people today get to the point where they have hit rock bottom, it's sometimes then and only then that they decide to. Okay. All right. It's sometimes then and only then when they begin to acknowledge things. I've mentioned a few times over the years I have in my library the Big Book. That's a book that was put out by Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a book which has a lot of stories, hard luck stories, and if you were ever to go to an AA meeting, and, I went one time, not because I had a problem with alcohol, I don't drink, but I went to just see what it was like, so I could, if people start talking about AA meetings, I'd have some sense of what was going on. And I was able to buy the book at the meeting, and I've read through it. I don't think I've read every word, but enough of it to know how it works. And they talk about people who hit rock bottom. And they'll go through in their meetings, at least the one that I was in, and I was told by an AA member that that was fairly typical. They will share these stories as kind of a reminder of where they were, what they've had to endure in the past, where alcohol addiction leads, and to encourage people to stay away from that. And one of the great lessons from that book for me was that people will not recognize their problem until they finally hit bottom. We deal with that sometimes with people too, don't we? Kids, you try to be nice to them sometimes, try to help them, do what you can for them, and they just never appreciate it. Sometimes, what's the only thing that's going to wake them up? All right, hard times, hard knocks. If you think the world is so much better out there, all right, and we're not kicking them out at the age of 7 or 8 or 10 or 12, but there comes a time where they can leave home and really see if life is that much better. So it's a hard way, the school of hard knocks, but certainly it is something that people do need to experience at times. All right, then at the top of 34, he says what concerning the house? Dad's home, he longed for it. If people are going to acknowledge their sin and turn from it, there has to be a desire for something else, isn't there? People have to reach the point where they're looking at the pig pen and say, this is not working, this is not healthy, this is not fun, this is painful, the food is bad or something else, and there must be something better. Can we take that point and apply it to the gospel? Are there not some people that we work with and they talk about how bad their life is? My marriage is on the rocks, my kids are in prison, I'm probably going to get fired from my job. You listen to all their difficulties. What's the message that we have as Christians? What did Jesus say in John chapter 10? I've come that they may have life, and that life is abundant life. I once heard, and I was a younger Christian at the time, but I once heard on a campaign, an experienced campaigner, when he went up to the door and knocked, his approach was, do you want abundant life? Now at the time, I thought that was pretty dumb. I thought if I were behind the door and somebody came up to me and said, do you want the abundant life? I, even as a Christian, I'm not sure that I would really connect. But you know, if you were to stack up the work of that personal worker and contrast it with other personal workers, he was as effective as others, if not more effective. And he'd been doing it for a number of years. To this day, it still puzzles me that people responded to that. But when you're dealing with people behind that closed door, as I said, their marriage is going down the tubes. They've just lost someone. They feel like there's no hope. The moral situation maybe in their community is in chaos. They have all kinds of difficulty. And somebody talks about the abundant life. Now, I may not know exactly what that is, but at least it sounds pretty good. And I might give you just 2 or 3 or 5 minutes of my time to learn a little bit more about that. So as Christians, that's what we're trying to offer to people. We're trying to say there is abundant life, there is a better way, there is hope for you, there is a way to deal with your situation. It may not deal with every issue immediately, but this is a way out, and we have that message for you.
It seems like there's a characteristic of society today that has deepened the barrel. I don't know any other way to put it. It, a number of decades ago, if the prodigal son, and I think it's an example of it, but even 25, 30 years ago, when he realized that he had screwed up, that he made a mess of his life, now he's going home. Today, whenever someone reaches the point at which the prodigal son reached, they'll start saying, it's because of him, it's because of that, it's because of whatever, but they won't admit the problem is their own. And like I said, I think it seems to me like it's driven the bottom of the barrel even deeper.
Well, that goes back to the comment that was made a few minutes ago, that people will blame almost anything but themselves. And that's really where the fix begins. AA has come to understand that. It's not your mom, it's not your dad, it's not your boss on the job, it's not your teacher or anybody else. The problem is with you. You are the one that chose to take that first drink. Nobody forced your mouth open. and, you know, poured bourbon, whiskey, whatever it might have been, down your throat, and you became involved with this problem. But taking responsibility in our day and time is something that fewer and fewer people seem to want to do. But that is the beginning point. People have to face up. Think about it in terms of the day of Pentecost. What do the people say? What must we do? They accepted personal responsibility. Then Peter was able to talk about the abundant life. But until they reached that point, Peter said, you've got to realize that you're guilty. You've got to realize that you're involved with sin. And unless you're willing to turn, the word repent, things are not going to get any better. Anybody else before? Okay. And then we'll have Lois read Luke 15:21.
When you start making those statements, it's not my fault, it's so-and-so, I don't think they've been bothered yet. I think there's still a way for them.
I would agree that at that point, they're still thinking we're going to get by. You know, things have gotten a little rough, so let's deflect blame over to this person or that group or whatever it might be, the government or the school, whatever it might be. And if they can continue their slide down, eventually, hopefully, they're going to reach the bottom and then look up and say, well, okay, it is me, and I need that help. Lois, let's look at Luke 15:21, please.
And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.
Let's fill in the blanks. The son says, I've done what? I've sinned. How widely had he sinned? He said, I've sinned against heaven, and he sinned against earth too, didn't he? His own family. He says, I've also sinned against you, Dad, in thy sight. And he says, too, I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Does it sound like this fella had hit bottom? I mean, he's down there at the very bottom, and he comes to that self-realization that the problem is with me. He comes back and says, I don't deserve anything, let alone to be called thy son. Make me a servant. Please have that much mercy. Show me that much grace. And, you know, I'll be satisfied with that. But Dad did much, much more. Then in the information before we get down to Matthew 13, Mark 4, verse 17, and Luke 8, verse 13, we have this statement. Some faults are caused by an inability to resist the temptations that come our way. Let's go to the Bible for some examples. Well, that's true. If you look at the problems with alcohol that we talked about earlier, or some things, generally there is a temptation out there which ensnares people. They act on it, and then, just like the child with the cookie jar, you know, there on the counter and puts his hand in it, there was a temptation. He thought it was too great, and he partakes, and some problems follow. Let's get somebody lined up for Matthew 13:21. Who wants to take that one? All right, Jeff, and after that we'll look at Mark 4, verse 17. Who wants to be your helper? Mark 4, verse 17. Dolores, and then Josh will ask you to pick up Luke chapter 8, verse 13. By the asterisk, he tells us those who are not rooted and built up in him and established in the faith, they will have trouble recognizing and resisting temptation. So let's start with Matthew 13:21.
Yet hath he not rooted himself, but dureth for a while. For when tribulation or persecution ariseth because of the word, by and by he is offended.
Okay, let's fill in our blanks and then think about it for a second. Jesus said, yet hath he not root. We understand what it means to be rooted when we look at the world that's around us. Doesn't have rooted himself, but for a little while, what's he do? He endures. And then when comes tribulation, or maybe something like persecution because of the word, what occurs? He's offended. He's not going to stick with it. How do we root people? And let's break this down into two sections. How do we root adults? Or maybe I can ask a preliminary question. Do adults need to be rooted?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, if they're going to be the people who are guiding homes, if they're going to be the people who are out there working in a business, if they're going to be the people who are training the next generation, they absolutely need to be rooted. Well, how are adults going to be rooted or firmly fixed, entrenched in what's right? All right, God's Word. There should be frequent study of that, trying to apply that, whether that's private study, public study. We would hope that that would, you know, be true in both instances. But there needs to be that connection to the Scriptures. What else? Root adults.
Well, I'd like to extend that, and that is to say it's by deepening, increasing faith, and obviously faith comes by hearing. So you need to go beyond just reading the Word. You have to be doers of the Word also.
All right. Continued exposure, we need the milk of the Word. We're also going to need the meat of the Word if we're truly going to be people who are rooted and grounded in the faith. What else can help us be rooted in the faith?
Good Christian family that you can be associated with.
All right, and that was the other major answer I was hoping that somebody would come up with. The Hebrew writer talked about that in Hebrews chapter 10, didn't he? Talked about exhorting one another, and so much the more as we see the day approaching. Christians can help root and ground one another. And if we're not doing that, once again, we're not going to be as strong as we can be. All right, if adults need to be rooted, then logically, who else would also need to be grounded? Our kids. And how are we going to do that?
Examples.
All right, and that means a consistent Christian example. Not a perfect Christian example, but there's going to be consistency while those kids are in the home or from grandparents, if you have association with your grandchildren. What else? Rooted and grounded. How are we going to do that with our kids? All right, teach them. And remember Deuteronomy chapter 6? You know, when you rise up, teach them. When they're going throughout the day, teach them. When it's time to go to bed at night, teach them. Teach, teach, teach. If we don't follow those kinds of strategies, will our kids be rooted and grounded in something else? The ways of the world. You have kids that are not rooted, they're not grounded well, they go off to school. Teacher comes along that they like. Evolution is true. The Bible's not true. The faith of your parents, it was good for them. But we know better because we've got our doctorate and this, that, and the other thing. And if kids are not rooted, they can be shaken and sometimes shaken loose from the faith. What else can we do to root our kids?
Don't overcompensate. Like, you know, sometimes you... giving them too much, or you can overcompensate by allowing them to make decisions when they're not old enough to do that yet.
It's a principle from Joshua 1. Joshua was told, don't go to the right, don't go to the left. There is that happy medium, there is the happy balance there. And if we want to root our kids well in the areas that you mentioned, plus virtually every other, strive for that middle ground so you've got well-balanced kids. What else can we do?
Encourage.
All right, I think that's going to be another thing. You know, they need to be encouraged. They need to be taught that nobody is perfect. Everybody's going to make mistakes. Mom and dad make mistakes. You're going to make some mistakes. But we can still serve God in a way that pleases Him. We can be His people if we will simply be faithful. Association with fellow Christians. We've talked about this in some recent lessons. Not only with kids their age, maybe some younger, maybe some older, but what about associating those kids with older folks? You've got a 5 or 7 year old, connect him in a positive way with somebody who's 50, 60, or 70 to show them that, hey, you know, these people still care about you. It's possible to be a Christian not only in the younger years, but as you continue to progress. And hopefully, as the years go by, you will pick up some of these additional qualities. So grounding people is essential. Mark 4, verse 17.
But since they have no roots, they last only a short time. When trouble or persecution from the word comes, they quickly fall away.
Okay. Filling in the blanks. Afterwards, when what comes? Affliction, maybe persecution for the word's sake. That's not always what happens, but sometimes that certainly is the reason for it. Then Jesus makes what point with this word? He says, immediately, doesn't take very long, they're offended. And then we'll pick up Luke chapter 8, verse 13 in just a second. Do you think, as adults and especially as kids, there are going to be times where there are those afflictions that come along and they're going to tempt us to not stay rooted and grounded? Now, as an adult, if we've been a Christian for a long time, we might say, well, I'm not trying to be proud, but I think I'm probably going to do pretty well. My desire is to stay rooted and grounded for God, and maybe we do stand in the time or in the times of great trial and tribulation. But for young children, hit the teenage years, 12, 13, 15, 18, maybe the 20s, kind of like a young tree. Maybe it's been beaten around a little bit, but now comes along a really big storm, and it's really going to be tested, and it's really going to be tried. Some of those trees snap. They don't stand. So when we think about our topic from Mark chapter 4, verse 17, it's a way of saying strive, not only personally, not only as adults, but with our kids, to make sure that they have been rooted and grounded to the point when these difficult times come, they will endure it. Well, if we've done that, is there anything else that we can do besides it? We've tried to root them and ground them and strengthen them over the years, but now, you know, they're 18, 19, 20, they're off to college, they've now reached a time where they've got young children, they're raising their families. is there any kind of future grounding that we can do, or additional grounding?
This may not be what you're thinking about, but it seems to me like the scriptures warn us to be careful, to be watchful, to be aware. And as we grow as adults, we have experienced a lot of these things, some more than others. But yet, when kids are growing up, well, one, we try to shield them from those things. Secondly, if they have some of those experiences, probably not to the extent that an adult. And then, when they reach the age at which they're going to separate from the parents, go out into the world, whatever, all of a sudden, boom, they get hit upside the head with something they had no idea even existed. So I believe that as parents, we can go a ways to alleviate that by forewarning.
That goes back to what Dolores said, where if you insulate them from every single thing, they get old enough, they're going to get blown away. And then if you don't protect them to a certain degree, they're going to get squashed before they get to the time where they are a young adult. So there is that fine balance there, trying to let them get beaten on a little bit, not beaten up, but beaten on a little bit. So they experience some things and they're able to stiffen the resolve. They're able to toughen up a little bit. You know, I'm a fan of, you know, asking questions of a lot of people. In the hospital the other day, I think she kind of got taken off guard, but there was, I think she was about 19, she said that she was in school, but she was a lab tech. And, you know, we were riding down to the first floor, and I asked her a couple questions. I said, what's your job like? Interesting? Yeah. I said, long term? Nah, just through till I get through college. And I said, well, what are some of the more challenging aspects of your job? She said, well, sometimes when I take blood, people kick me. And sometimes when I take blood from people, they spit on me. And she didn't go any further than that. But it was kind of interesting to listen to her. And as, you know, I don't know anything about her background, but somebody hadn't prepared her for those kinds of things. And, that, you know, in college, for example, she could have been prepared that if you're going to take blood, then these are some of the things that you might experience, because she kind of indicated that she came into that profession and she just was not expecting some of the things that she experienced. And kids can do the same kind of thing. So, do you think as parents we could ask our kids some questions? We might at some point pull out two passages that seem to be, for example, in Galatians chapter 6, Paul said, bear your own burden, and then he said, bear the burdens of others. Those statements seem to be contradictory. You think we could with our kids as they're growing up, or maybe with grandkids, and say, hey, I've got a question for you. Oh, yeah, you're smart, okay. And say, we've got these two passages over here. Do you think they're contradictory? Could they go together in some way? Challenge kids to think about the Bible. Ask kids, you know, various things. If I wanted some information on this topic. So, once again, we're trying to train that tree, if you will, to the point where it's able to withstand some of the difficulties in life. And then to follow up on what Stan said, what happens when the kids, and Teresa and I are kind of in this boat now, your kids are younger, early 20s, maybe they're around 30, and they've started families of their own. Do you think they're going to have some, at least small, crises of faith at various times? Do you think that it would be right as a parent? Now, we're not trying to interfere. We're not trying to run down there and live with them and say, okay, this is the right thing to do and we're going to take over your household. None of that. Because the Bible does say, leave and cleave. You set up your own household. However, do you think it would be right, consistent with God's will, to try to ground those kids, or especially our kids, in the faith as they deal with some of the things that we faced earlier in life? Absolutely. So when we think about trying to help people, sometimes it's our families, our friends, maybe somebody that we have a distant connection to, but that strengthening process should be something that we try to do on a regular basis.
And when I said don't overcompensate, I wasn't really, maybe in a small way, referring to material goods. I'm more talking about, you know, it's okay to let them see that, hey, we're struggling financially. Mm-hmm. We're eating from Aldi's. We're eating, you know, chicken necks all winter one year with our kids. 10 cents a pound. I found all kinds of ways to do things with chicken necks that I never dreamed possible. But the kids are okay from that. And it's good for them to struggle in a lot of ways, because like a dandelion, you know, a dandelion can come out of a rock. Well, that's how I figure our kids' roots should be. And they don't have to go through a bad time to experience that, but you know, don't try to shield them from a problem like that. They're part of it, and that's a growing process. And then when they're married and have their own families, they can see, well, you know, mom and dad struggled through this. We all struggled through it together. So I guess I'm going to make it too.
Well, I can remember because my dad worked for John Deere. That was a union-based job, so you've always got contract time coming up. Teresa's dad was in the same boat. We had several of the families that were in that same situation. When contract time comes, you know, it can be kind of a dicey matter. And there were some times for some families in the area where Teresa and I grew up that they had a shutdown. And again, you know, your income has been substantially reduced or maybe removed for a period of time. And I can think of some cases where kids were told, and this was true in my family as well, we just don't want to run out and share that information, you know, right now, that times are tough, but I mean, that's true for us and true for several other families. But we want you to realize that we will have some food on the table. It may be eggs, it may be macaroni and cheese for a while. You are not going to go hungry. However, we also want you to realize that life is not always going to run on the same plane. There are going to be some hard times, some difficult times in life. And right now we can help you work through those things because, you know, we're the parents, we're going to take care of those matters for you. But this is kind of a precursor to what you may experience in life. Now, maybe you don't, and I don't think my parents wished hard times on me. My sister and Teresa's family certainly didn't do that for her. But it does help brace or fortify or aid them in the world, whether it's from a physical standpoint or whether it's from a spiritual standpoint. And I think as kids get older, you know, Palmer's could probably attest to this, Ray could probably attest to this, and Betty and some others that are in the, you know, 50++ category. Let's just describe it that way.
Be careful.
That's, yeah, well, I tried to be, okay?
Just
stand. Yeah, you just stand. So we just point right directly to him. But, you know, as kids get into those ages where they're, you know, maybe early 20s, mid-30s and so forth, parents may share more and more information. Things that kids didn't realize and probably couldn't have accepted well. For example, you might have a parent say, I fell out of love with your mother or father. You know, when their kids are going through some marital difficulties, as a means of encouraging them. This is not, you know, the first time that this has happened. It's happened within our family, those kinds of things. And it can be very, very helpful. All right, Luke 8, just pick up verse 13, if you would. Okay.
We take our children, we teach them at home and things, and we warn them about some of the friends they might have. Okay, but now they get away to college, no longer at home or living at home or anything, and they meet up with some other friends there. Well, they're friends that go to church, and they seem like pretty good friends, but they can still be leading them astray, even though initially they thought they were pretty good friends.
Yeah. Advice from mom and dad is not always going to be taken, but you can try to present that in a constructive and thoughtful way and just say, here's some things that you may want to consider. Here's some things that have happened to some others, maybe mom and I, those kinds of things, because you do have those dangers. And until kids really feel like they've got good roots, and I mean, that's still no guarantee that somebody will stick with it. But until they've got that, you know, it's kind of like watching that plant, you know, every single day and making sure you're doing everything that you can to nourish it and strengthen it. Paul did that with congregations, as did some others. So it's certainly right to deal with that on an individual basis.
On that, I can't remember the verse where it talks about you raise your children in the way of the Lord, they'll never depart. So you start when you're young, and some of us have seen that happen where they kind of get off and do their own thing, and later they are calling you and talking about needing spiritual guidance.
Yeah. That's a general principle from Proverbs. It's not an absolute promise because we do, for example, think about Cain and Abel. You know, God counseled Cain and he still didn't come back. And if God wasn't able to turn him around, you know, no parent was going to have that ability.
You never say never, right?
You never say never. But you do have that general principle where you've trained the child in that way. So when those times come, more than likely they're inclined to turn back to spiritual things. And maybe mom and dad, you know, they can pull from that example. Or thinking about turning back to God, showing up at services at some place. We've had that here. And most congregations do, where somebody has come back and said, I've been away. I mentioned before, Don and I one day went down and saw a guy shortly before he died. He'd been out of service for the Lord for, I believe, 50-plus years. And now he's, you know, close to the time of death. He's sick and so forth. And Don and I talked to him, and from everything that I could tell, he was restored, and then shortly thereafter, he dies. But again, been several cases of that where later in life people finally get it right. Okay, let's pick up with Luke 8, verse 13. Josh, is that you?
Yep. And the ones on the rock are those who, when they hear the word, receive it with joy. But these have no root. They believe for a while, and in time of testing, fall away.
Okay. When you look at the context, it would involve someone who becomes a Christian, and before they're well-rooted, before they're well-grounded, there's something that comes up that tempts them. A lot of things could cause that, and then they do fall away, maybe restored at a later time, maybe not. But we do want to be mindful of that, because that can happen to all people, regardless of how well-grounded they are. All right, next section here on page 34, the middle of the page, it says, those who allow temptations to harden their hearts. He pulls from Hebrews chapter 3, Hebrews 3, verses 7 and 8, and then in the next section we have 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 9, used as a reference. Get two more helpers lined up. Who wants to take care of Hebrews chapter 3, verses 7 and 8? Betty, is that you? Okay. And then we'll also look at 1 Timothy chapter 6, where Paul has some things to say about money. 1 Timothy 6, 9 will be read by Sherman. Okay, in Hebrews 3, 7 and 8, we have some information about the Israelites and when they were tried in the wilderness. We have, from our passage, it'll be read an answer to this question. Today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation in the day of where? Let's pick it up. Betty, Hebrews 3, 7 and 8. Okay, I think I said where it should have been what. In the day of what? In the day of temptation, and where was that? They were tempted in the wilderness. Well, if we try to put that into spiritual terms, going back to what we're talking about as far as the grounding, if our kids are put in a position where they're going to be tempted to leave the faith, or you have adults, they're not grounded very well and they start to sway, more than likely, where will those temptations come from? Inside or outside the church? All right. You can have some come from inside, but I think generally you're going to find the majority of them in the wilderness, outside. So that's where Israel faced their problems. And today, it's also where a lot of difficulties pop up for people, especially in the earlier years, because there's so many things out there that they may not be familiar with. He adds, many during their pilgrimage there, they lost their patience and said and did things that were wrong because they were tempted, and in their hearts, they were hardened against God's way for them. Same kinds of things occur today. Sherman, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 9.
But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition.
Okay. We sometimes have definitions for words that are not consistent with the Bible definition for words. And here is an example of that. When we think about the word rich, from an American perspective, who's rich?
Somebody else.
Yeah, it's always somebody else. How much money do you need to have to be rich? What would you say is the minimum?
A lot.
Well, yeah, I need something a little more specific than a lot.
Millions.
All right, you know, we probably would, maybe some would say half a million, but probably a million enough. I think for most people they would say, okay, now you're definitely in the rich category. Well, there are not probably too many people that we know that are sitting on that much cash. However, that's our definition. That's not the Bible definition. When you look at the scriptures, what do you find as far as the average person?
The average person in the Bible is fairly poor.
Yes. I mean, you know, Jesus talks about, remember Matthew chapter 6, what kind of bread are daily bread, remember? It's not that they were making trips to Walmart 7 days a week. But it was, you are paid a daily wage. You know, we say, well, if we don't go to work, you know, we got a sick day, or we've got a vacation day, a personal day, whatever it might be. And, you know, we've got, you know, 4 or 5 other days on the paycheck. And we've got some money in the bank. And we've got a credit card that we can use. And we've got a savings account that we could pull from. And if things get really desperate, we can, get a short-term loan, which they were obviously able to do that kind of thing as well. But their options were a lot more limited than our options today. And we would be not only rich, but if you went back and looked at the people in the first century and they looked at our life, they would say you as a middle-class person or even someone who would be below the poverty line is rich by today's standards. Thus, when we look at 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 9, he says, but they that would be rich, we're already there. He says they fall into what? temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. Well, if we're already rich, then would you say this verse can be applied to us or not? Absolutely. What would the application be? We're rich, but many want to be
richer.
That's the key word. Well, if we're already rich and we want to be richer, then would it not follow that there are still many foolish, hurtful, and destructive lusts that can befall us? Absolutely. In fact, we might even say that we're more susceptible to that than some people in the past. Now, that's not always true, but that is possible. Then I wanted to ask, too, give some examples of that quickly. How people can pierce themselves through with many sorrows as they either want to become rich or they want more than what they have if they are rich. How does that happen? Why does that happen?
They want to keep up with the Joneses.
All right.
Other people.
Yeah. People are feeling inadequate. They feel unequal to people who have achieved more, so there's a lack of happiness and satisfaction, contentment there. What else? Sherman?
This kind of goes along with what he said, that the New King James Version that I read, I like the word desire because that makes sound like that's what they want to do. What it says in our book here says it will be. But, you can't really apply that to everybody that's rich. But somebody that desires it, the only thing they want, they're going to work so many hours they never have any time for God. They don't have time for family.
I think that's one of the great answers that we can give concerning here. People, they lose their health. They waste their life looking for those kinds of things. You can imagine someone who, it's almost like the rich farmer that Jesus talked about in Luke chapter 12. I've got this, my retirement package is all set up, got plenty of food, and then Jesus said, thou fool, what's true? Tonight, you're going to die. Your soul's going to be required of you, and you've made some very bad choices. So we do want to be mindful of that. All right, then he talks about the people who have a low resistance to lust. He says, pulling from Proverbs 7, verse 21, let's go through verse 23 as well. He doesn't have verses 22 and 23, but let's have those two verses read. And then we'll also...
One before that, I think. Did we already read the misprint they have there? The love of money is the root of all evil?
Well, that's the King James translation.
Yeah, it's the root of all kinds of evil.
Yes, and it's not the only root of evil.
Right, exactly.
But it is a root.
Right.
So the ASV and some other translations have removed the word definite article, the word be, to show that it's not exclusively
that. Yeah, they're just saying that sin is controlled just by money. So
yes, there are a lot of things. And you can see that with the next item here, as far as lust. Many times lust has absolutely nothing to do with money, but yet still it would fall into the category of evil.
One other comment I would make is that you talk about the search for riches. It's very easy for people who consider themselves poor to have money as their idol.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they don't have the money, they still, everything is about money. So they can be just as much as an idol as someone who's got a lot of money.
Absolutely. And that desire can involve not just money, but it can involve some other things as well, where they become consumed, they become obsessed by that. So it falls, because of the great obsession, it falls into the category of idolatry because they focus on the wrong thing. So, okay, lust. Proverbs 7, 21 to 23, and then let's also head somebody over to 2 Peter chapter 3, 17 and 18. Who wants to be a Proverbs 7 reader? Proverbs 7, 21 to 23. Jeff? And then let's get somebody lined up for 2 Peter 3, 17 and 18. 2 Peter 3, 17 and 18. Julie? Okay. Darren, how about you? 2 Peter 3, 17 and 18. All right, Proverbs 7, 21 to 23.
With her much flattered speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life.
Okay. You have here a reference to a prostitute. Now, prostitution has always puzzled me, if for no other reason, the diseases that are associated with it. I mean, you go back and you look at history, it's been a problem, not only in the Old West, but you go back into the first century, they've had brothels, and it has been a huge, huge issue for people. And yet, even though it's killed some people, even though it's left some people with some terrible diseases that doctors maybe are able to knock back but not completely cure, you still have people who become involved with it. Here, the text says, he nevertheless became a victim, and let a skilled, smooth talker, that is a female prostitute, lead him on, little by little until she had him in her clutches. Verse 21 says, with her fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. Well, you know, I don't know that we need a lot of explanation concerning what the text says, but you have people that offer different incentives. You know, this is what you want. I'll do what you want. The price is going to be right. It's going to be reasonable. People have said all kinds of things to compel people or convince people to do something. And in this case, prostitutes have presented people with an offer in different ways that have caused them to fall prey to the tempter. He mentions, too, after that, those who yield to constant pressure. This is another problem. I can remember a fella. He had a problem with pornography. And he decided that if he was going to go the typical way to his house, he was going to pass a porn shop every time. Well, my suggestion was to him, do you have any other way to go home? Well, yeah, a couple miles longer if I turn the other way. Go the other way. And you just make that decision on a regular basis. You just don't go because you're going to have that constant pressure. Your eyes are more than likely going to be directed to that. You're going to be thinking about that, and there's going to be the temptation to stop. Now, could he have gone the other way and decided to turn back around and visit the shop? Absolutely. Nothing was stopping him from doing that. But one of the things that causes people to become involved with something is that continuous pressure. Ray mentioned earlier, 1 Corinthians 15:33, evil companionships corrupt good morals. There is, in that context, reference to false teachers, but still, there is that constant, there is that ongoing pressure. Samson was someone who suffered from this when it came to Delilah, and finally, as we know the rest of the story, things didn't work out too well for him. All right, 2 Peter 3:17 and 18. Okay, thank you. Peter, in the second letter, has a lot to say about false teachers. Here, as he talks about false teachers, he recognizes that some people who do that kind of thing can be very, very convincing. They may have a lot of enthusiasm. People may say they're doing so many good things, and yet Peter says none of that justifies or should allow us to approve of what they're doing. Filling in the blanks, he says, "Ye therefore, beloved, seeing ye know these things." And not only do you know these things about false teachers, he says you've known them from when? Before. You've been grounded in the truth about false teachers. You know this stuff. So he says, first point, the blank is, you need to beware. You know this, but still you need to be watchful. Lest ye also be led away into the error of the wicked and in the knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. You need to grow. Then in 1 Kings chapter 13, we have the young prophet. He ends up dying. Because of a lion, false prophet convinces him to do the opposite of what God wanted him to do. And that correlates well with 1 John chapter 4, verse 1. John told the brethren, "Beloved, don't believe every spirit, but you need to try, test, check out the spirits, because there are many false prophets gone out into the world." And that is still a huge, huge problem. If we're weak, then we want to admit it. We want to seek help and not be led away by false teachers. Let's finish this out quickly, filling in the blanks. A brother can be overtaken in a sin, fault, trespass. So what do we need to do? Restore him. Matthew 6, verse 13. Jesus said, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." Then 35 and 36, these pages. "No one is tempted beyond what he can bear, for God will make a way of escape." A lot of times I think people assume that the way of escape is going to be easy or hard. Oh, God's just going to let me right off. Well, that's not always the case, and that's one of the things we need to communicate to our kids. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation, even though the flesh is weak, Matthew 26:41. We can overcome because greater is God than the one who's in the world, that's the devil. Psalm 139:24, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, test me, check me out, know my thoughts. And see if there is anything wicked in me, and do what for me? Lead me in the way everlasting." God is with us. When we mess up, we want to make sure that we acknowledge it.